Dragnet.
The Jack Benny Program.
I'm that man. Matt Dillon, United States Marshal.
George Burns and Gracie Allen.
Good evening, friends of the Inner Sanctum.
We offer you Escape.
Our Miss Brooks.
Suspense.
Richard Diamond, Private Detective.
Fibber McGee and Molly.
The Great Gildersleeve.
Yeah. Radio Theater.
In the air.
Dedicated to man's imagination, the theater of the mind.
You know what our call letters WGN stand for, don't you?
WGN Radio Theater.
The special three-hour presentation.
With Carl Amari and Lisa Wolf.
All right, welcome to WGN Radio Theater. It's Dave Plyer.
Hey, Dave.
It's Mike Costello. What's going on, buddy?
I'm doing well. How are you?
We are in for Carl and Lisa, which is a rare moment.
Yes.
When both of them are off at the same time.
Yes.
This might be the only moment that both of them have been off at the same time.
Well, I think they went to a Halloween party.
That's what happens when you're still hungover.
Yeah.
You just can't host your show that night.
But I'm here and you're here, so we're okay.
We are okay. We are all right. So I love this time of year because in the world of old-time radio, this is the way I was introduced to old-time radio, was Lights Out and Suspense and all these creepy horror shows, because this really kind of conjured up that theater of the mind experience,
right?
Listening to all this stuff, right?
Absolutely.
So, and Suspense is one of my favorites, and I know we've got a few great shows tonight. What do we got coming up?
We've got The Black Museum in this hour. It's an episode from 1952, The Champagne Glass with Orson Welles, and we also have Mystery in the Air in hour two, an episode called Crime and Punishment from September 25th, 1947.
Now, I know WGN was a mutual broadcasting station, and I believe in the early 1950s we still were, but this was something that aired on Radio Luxembourg in London,
right?
And but now it's for some reason one full year it aired here in the States
on the mutual network. Yes,
and it's got Orson Welles. So
yeah.
how do you mess that up? That's
right.
Fantastic. Yeah, and then who's the other one?
What do you mean?
Or the next show after that?
Oh, Mystery in the Air in hour two. That's Crime and Punishment, September 25th, 1947.
Very cool. So both kind of good, dark little mysteries going on.
It's got Peter Lorre
tonight.
In it, so
you can't beat that.
Creepy.
I know, very creepy, very creepy. Speaking of which, so when Carl asked me to co-host with you, I said, you know, I got to bring something that is pretty cool to share, and we're going to actually kick off the show with this, is back on WGN Radio in the days of Eddie Schwartz and Steve and Johnny when they were doing overnights, they would always have a ghost hunter on the show. And that ghost hunter was the late Richard Crowe. And, you know, the big focus would be on Resurrection Mary and Archer Avenue and the Willowbrook Ballroom and all those good things. So I thought before we kicked off the old-time radio shows tonight, we'd play a little bit of this. Now, this came from a friend of mine. His dad, who's since passed away, used to tape these overnight shows, especially the horror ones, on reel-to-reel. So we transferred this from, I think this is from 1980, maybe 1981. We transferred this into HD so that we could share a little bit with you tonight. So here is a classic WGN radio interview with Eddie Schwartz and ghost hunter Richard Crowe.
The first time that we ever got together on the radio, this is one of the things we talked about. We've talked about it every time since. I doubt there's a person you ever run into who knows what you do who doesn't want to hear this famous story. This one has put Chicago on the ghostly map, hasn't it?
It certainly has. And of all the stories told about Chicago, the one that instantly grabs the attention of people, no matter where they're from in the United States, no matter where they're from in the world, they all want to hear about Resurrection Mary. Of course, hitchhiking ghosts as a genre, if you will, are well known around the world. There are hitchhiking ghosts in just about every country on the face of the globe. But when it comes to the Chicago area, the most famous hitchhiking ghost, and one that is so often encountered, is that of Resurrection Mary.
What does the hitchhiking represent, if you've been able to pin that down?
What does the hitchhiking represent? Well, I have found certain trends, certain common denominators in many ghost stories. And the idea of motion plays in so many. So we have rocking chair ghosts, the rocking motion back and forth, and the just driving along the highway, driving along the roadway. just sets up a certain mood and a certain atmosphere. Perhaps that's something to do with it too. It just seems to fit so very, very, very well and come together so very, very well that the hitchhiking ghost, common around the country and here in Chicago, is so very, very well known along Archer primarily, either into the city or out of the city, one way or the other, passing by Resurrection Cemetery in Justice, Illinois, 7400 South Archer.
What is the date we're talking about? This story goes back how many years?
Now we can trace stories back. I've interviewed people as far back who've had their experiences back as far as 1939. Mm. And one gentleman who appeared on That's Incredible, Southwest Side Man, told me how he had his personal incident at Liberty Grove and Hall, 47th and Mozart. This was a little hall that was active in the pre-World War II days. It has since been torn down. There's just housing there. He met the young girl at the dance, danced with her over and over again. And later that evening, since she didn't seem to know anybody else in the place, and he was having such a grand time with her, he asked her, well, do you need a ride home? And she readily accepted. But they got in the car and they started down Archer in the towards the area of Justice, Illinois. When they got near the cemetery gates, she said, please pull the car to the side of the road. He did. She said, I must cross the road at this point. You cannot follow me. She suddenly jumped from the car and ran towards those gates and then disappeared before she got to them. And it's then this man realized that he had just had a most unusual experience. And the girl, of course, was none other than Resurrection Mary, the famous ghost. So this young lady named Mary, blonde in a white dress, has been encountered like that a number of times over the years, or just seen walking along the road, seen walking across the road from the cemetery, or along the cemetery fence, or in and out through the gates. And as you know, Ed, I'm sure you know that area quite well, particularly on if it's a full moon night or very a bright night, as many of the instances are of the encounters of Resurrection Mary. If you know the area, you know there's nowhere to hide. A blonde in a white dress is highly visible. Where is she going to go?
Hmm.
And one good thing about Southsiders these days, or just people in general that are traveling by the Resurrection Cemetery area, nobody takes it passively anymore. Nobody drives by, sees something that looks like Resurrection Mary, and keeps going. I would venture to say that 99 people out of 100 are going to slam on the brakes immediately and jump out and check it out for themselves, or make a U-turn, or make some attempt to get right back to the spot, to grab that girl, find out just what's going on. It's certainly not a prankster dressing up. That is certainly not the case in these stories. And in the few seconds it takes to stop the car, turn around, come back, the girl is gone. She disappears.
The question, of course, is who was she? I can't say who is she, but who was she?
Right,
and
who was she?
And why does she prowl Archer and Justice in the cemetery and come and go? Why does she not rest?
That's a very hotly debated topic, and you can get into all kinds of arguments in local halls or bars down along Archer. And there are a few schools of thought about that. And there are, in fact, a few candidates for the title of Resurrection Mary. Resurrection, as we mentioned earlier, is the largest cemetery in North America, according to many. There are tens of thousands of graves out there. That's tens of thousands of possibilities.
Hmm.
In a Polish-American cemetery, there's a lot of blonde, blue-eyed young ladies buried there. I'm sure many of whom, when they left this world, if they left this world in a young age, didn't really care to leave it. And if they did have the choice in the matter, and if they could come back, they would come back. So there's many possibilities, and I am fairly sure there's got to be more than one ghost involved, and this is based on interviewing people who were told by the ghost when she was around what her name was, where she lived. There's at least two girls coming back as ghosts. There's quite possibly three, and my list of candidates is it runs more than half a dozen. And it depends on who you talk to, and depends on other factors as to various minor points and how the appearance takes place, how the ghost acts, the MO of the ghost, if you will. But there's I'm sure there's more than one ghost involved. There has to be a number of ghosts just to account for the great number of occurrences and the different variety of occurrences. We've got girls walking around the area at night, in and out through the gates. We've got the classic hitchhiking thing, the classic idea of the ghost getting into a car, and much, much more.
And there you have it. That was the legendary Eddie Schwartz. You said the quality of that's pretty good, right?
Yeah.
I think that was taped off air. So, I mean, I don't know if he had a mic up.
But, I mean, the storage of the tape over time, you know, he must have stored it properly.
Yeah, probably. But that was a tradition, man. He'd come on every single year. And Rick Hogan was just telling me we used to write about him all the time.
He's
quite
interesting.
A character. Very interesting stuff. The Black Museum and Mystery in the Air, two great shows coming up after this on 720 WGN. All right, we got our first show coming up here. Mike, what do we got happening?
Yeah, we got the Black Museum from 1952. It's an episode called The Champagne Glass with Orson Welles. So, as you know, this show usually starts out, or always starts out, in Scotland Yard's Black Museum, which is pretty much a crime museum. I believe it still exists, and
really?
It's not open to the public. I was reading some notes. It's not anywhere we can go and go check things out.
Wow.
But basically, Orson Welles is going to walk through, look at some artifacts, pick one up, and then we're going to learn about some
kind of crime that
happened with that. So this is obviously going to be about a champagne glass.
Very cool.
So here we go. This is going to be the first portion of the Black Museum, The Champagne Glass, with Orson Welles from 1952.
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
The Black Museum, a repository of death. Yes, here in the grim stone structure on the Thames, which houses Scotland Yard, is a warehouse of homicide. Where everyday objects, a man's necktie, a woman's glove, a boy's school cap, all are touched by murder. Now here's a champagne glass. That's a familiar object. Long stem, delicate curve, shining crystal. This fragile object belongs to New Year's Eve, to weddings and to anniversaries.
Funny about things like this, Sergeant.
Funny, sir? I'd say that one was loaded.
I meant funny in a philosophical sense, Sergeant. Funny how human beings can take an article meant for happiness and use it for tragedy.
Well, anyway, that champagne glass can be found today in the Black Museum.
From the annals of the Criminal Investigation Department of the London Police, we bring you the dramatic stories of the crimes recorded by the objects in Scotland Yard's Gallery of Death, the Black Museum.
Well, here we are. Black Museum. Scotland Yard's museum of murder. This place echoes with violent death. Voices are hollow here, whether the hollowness is caused by the high-vaulted ceilings or by the reaction of the human mind to the atmosphere of this room. The effect is the same. Everybody who comes here learns a sense of fear. It's natural, because here lies death. Death, cruel, unnecessary, vengeful, or greedy. Still the kind of death brought by one man or one woman on another. This is a record to be studied not merely by criminologists, but by every student of man's inhumanity to man. Here's an iron skillet. It's heavy in your hand, the kind of kitchen utensil your grandmother used. Well balanced, quite suitable for frying eggs or veal chops, or for bashing a skull, perhaps. There's little doubt as to the use which brought this particular skillet here. Yes. And here's the champagne glass. It's well designed, graceful. You could place it with a companion on a silver tray, as Colonel Harry Reed did. You could pop a cork and then fill the glasses, as Colonel Harry Reed did. And you might say, as the dapper colonel did,
to you, my dear Elizabeth, to your return and your complete recovery.
I wish I could drink to that wholeheartedly, Harry. Really, I do.
Well, why not, my dear? You've been released, you're...
That's it, exactly. I've been released. Not merely sent home from hospital, so to speak. After all, the hospital I was in had bars in the windows.
Oh, I insist, my dear, that you touch glasses with me and drink at once. That's no way to talk.
But, Harry,
Ah, then no buts, Elizabeth. Many people have had nervous breakdowns, and the vast majority of them have recovered.
Very well, Harry, dear. But not to me, to you, the most patient of husbands in the world.
So they drank the champagne, and all was well. It was very pleasant, very relaxing, reassuring. But the world is always too much with us, and the Colonel finally had to say...
Now, you rest until dinner, Elizabeth. I have a brief appointment with my solicitor, Davis. You remember him?
Must you, dear, tonight?
Well, it's at his request. I won't be long.
And the Colonel kissed his wife, and the Colonel went off to his appointment.
It's 6 months now, Reed. One way or the other, the matter ought to be settled.
I assure you, Davis, there's nothing to worry about. These things take time.
There's been plenty of time. Look, Reed, if you don't want to complete the deal, return the £500.
But it's not up to me. My client...
Your client indicated willingness to dispose of the property. My client paid the deposit in good faith. We consider it a binder on the contract. We've waited 6 months.
Your £500 is quite safe, Davis. You can reassure your client. And on my side, we'll go through with the deal as soon as everything is clear.
Well, I certainly hope so. My people want to take possession.
And they shall. They shall indeed. And soon. Meanwhile, there's no reason for misunderstanding between us, is there? After all, we live in the same small town. We see each other constantly. You know, John, I've often wondered why we don't see more of each other. Oh, socially, that is.
Rather a changeable fellow, the Colonel, isn't he? There were other changes ahead, more serious ones. They first came to somewhat public notice the night our Colonel called Dr. Ashley to his home.
Ah, Dr. Ashley. Good of you to come so quickly.
You made it sound rather urgent, Colonel. Is it really serious?
Yes, sir. I'm afraid, Doctor. Really afraid. It's my wife.
Has she broken down again?
No. She complains of terrible pain in her abdomen.
I'd better see her at once.
Yeah, this way, please. If you can, Doctor.
Yes?
She seems to me to be as much frightened as she is in pain.
Oh? What exactly do you mean by that?
Frightened that, that her pain is in her imagination.
I see. Oh, very well. I'll bear that in mind, Colonel.
Ah, in here.
If you'll wait outside, Colonel, please.
Oh, must I, Doctor?
I prefer it.
Very well.
Now then, Mrs. Reed. Can you hear me, Mrs. Reed?
The good Colonel waited outside the door. Up and down, back and forth, he paced, almost as if he were once again on guard duty. Grim-faced, tense, he waited. At long last.
You'd better come in, Colonel. Quick.
Doctor, is she...
I'm afraid so. I've done everything I can.
Moments later, Elizabeth Reed was at rest, at last. Tears streamed down the Colonel's cheeks, but he was silent. There seemed nothing to say. The doctor led him away and told him gently.
It was acute gastritis and her heart. You'll want the minister, I assume, and the mortician. I'll send the certificate over. Natural causes...
There was a well-attended funeral. The flowers were piled high in tribute to the Colonel's position in the town as well as to the memory of his wife. And then the Colonel resumed his life, somewhat more lonely but still active, bearing himself in military fashion as he went about his small real estate business, and time drifted by. 1 month, two, and then one day on the main street.
Good morning, Colonel.
Ah, Davis, good to see you.
I've hesitated discussing this... Your recent bereavement and so on, but don't you think we need to close our deal, Reed?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course. I'm rather by myself these days. Would you care to join me for tea or a bit something stronger one afternoon?
You say when, Reed. I'll be glad to.
Excellent. Then, shall we say tomorrow, five-ish?
Why not? Your place? or mine?
Well, mine, of course. Delighted to have you.
All right, and that is part one of the Black Museum. I'm Dave Plyer along with Mike Costello, and there's more on the WGN Radio Theater after the news next on 720 WGN.
Back to WGN Radio Theater with Earl Amari and Lisa Wolf.
Well, Carl and Lisa, as we mentioned earlier, they're hungover, so they couldn't be here. It's Dave Plyer and Mike Costello filling in for them tonight. We're listening to the Black Museum with Orson Welles. So this is a British show. He did an American show here. He was Mercury on the Air was his big show, and of course, War of the Worlds was his big thing that happened. I think almost what year was that? I think it was 37. He was so busy. It's just a little fun fact. So busy with so many radio shows in different parts of New York City. He hired ambulances to drive him around New York City so they could get to his destination on time.
Ooh, nice.
From one studio. That's brilliant. I might try that. All right, what do we got?
We are listening to the Black Museum from 1952, The Champagne Glass with Orson Welles. Here's portion two.
Have a scone, old man. Really excellent. My housekeeper has quite the touch.
Thank you, I will.
Almost as if we were a pair of elderly ladies. Tea and scone.
Two gentlemen, somewhat past middle age, enjoying tea and scones and making ready to discuss business. In fact, they did discuss business, the £500 deposit and the pending deal. And John Davis went home quite satisfied. John Davis went home and a little later called Dr. Ashley.
I can't understand it, Doctor. My stomach's like cast iron. Always has been. Now, suddenly, this.
None of us are quite as young as we used to be. Even cast iron can wear thin with youth. Eat anything out of the ordinary, John? Today? Yesterday?
No, nothing. Had some scones for tea. The butter may have been a bit rancid, but tasted perfectly fresh. Over a kettle of reeds.
Eh? Reeds?
Yes, that's why. We had a little business to discuss. He asked me over. Seems quite lonely since his wife passed on. So I went, mostly to keep him company.
Oh, nice of you. Well, just take the prescription I'm leaving you. Rest a day or two. You'll be all right.
What's wrong, Doctor?
Oh, nothing. Just a quirk of memory.
Oh? How so?
Your symptoms and Mrs. Reed's rather the same. Nothing serious about it. Just odd that we should have two similar cases in such close juxtaposition. A town like this, a doctor gets to know most of the illness.
As the doctor said, nothing serious. Just an interesting coincidence. And in a day or so, John Davis was up and about. Aside from a slight tenderness in his abdomen, he felt no after effects. All was well. All was quiet. Everyone was his courteous self, including Colonel Reed.
Well, now, candy. And from the Colonel. How decent of him. Here it is, Doctor. The same wrappings it came in.
Nice looking box. Don't you care for candy, John? You haven't eaten much.
As a matter of fact, I don't. I did offer a piece to the charwoman at the office. You see, one's missing.
The charwoman, eh? Is that the way you treat a gift? With the hope you are sufficiently recovered to enjoy this, Harry Reed. Rather decent of him.
That's what I thought. Until the charwoman was taken with pains and reaching an hour after she ate the candy.
Are you suggesting anything, John?
That would be slanderous at this stage, wouldn't it?
There's nothing to it, John. There couldn't be. The Colonel's...
Well, I inquired at the probate office. He did rather well following his wife's death and her will, you know. He never had any money of his own to speak of. Former military men rarely do.
Yes, it might be interesting. I've done practically no laboratory work of my own for some time. But I have a little equipment. Shall I try my hand at a bit of chemical analysis, John? I'm curious about the contents of that box of candy. You seem to be as well as I.
The doctor was methodical, to say the least. He took his time setting up his equipment, preparing reagents, making ready for his private little tests. Meanwhile, John Davis ran into his friend the Colonel on the street.
John, good to see you.
How are you, Harry? You're looking fit.
Well, I try to keep that way. Well, care to join me for another attack of indigestion, old man?
Well, today, the champagne glass we've been talking about can be seen, as you might expect, among the other exhibits in the Black Museum. The colonel and John Davis parted quite amicably on the street. Davis watched the smart military walk the ramrod straight back as the colonel paraded into his own business office. John Davis shook his head. Somehow it didn't seem quite plausible that this man might be something quite different than what he seemed. The next afternoon, the telephone rang in John Davis's office.
Yes?
Oh, that you, John? This is Harry here.
Harry? Oh, yes, yes, of course. How are you?
Ah, very well. And you?
Quite well.
No more stomach ache?
No trace.
Well, then, how about this evening?
Oh, sorry, old man, I can't this evening. Oh. But perhaps in a day or so.
Oh, too bad. Well, I'll be speaking to you. Goodbye.
Bye.
That evening, Davis had a previous appointment with Dr. Ashley in his makeshift laboratory.
This little operation here is the Marsh test.
Oh?
For arsenic.
Interesting.
Yes, isn't it? Particularly since I found that every piece of candy in your gift box had arsenic in it.
Good Lord!
Arsenic, you see, is a cumulative poison. A person may have a tolerance for quite a large amount of it. But it usually fails to pass through the human system. It accumulates, and bit by bit, the fatal dose is built up until one day the victim dies. Dr. Ashley explained all this to John Davis. Finally, John grasped the significance of the facts.
Each piece of candy would never bother the ordinary stomach or the cast iron type such as you boasted you have. Most people could eat a piece or two and nothing would happen. But if, as it may have been intended, you had eaten most of the candy yourself, well, you follow me, I gather?
Follow you? Doctor, I'm a step ahead of you. But exactly what that step is, I'm not sure. I think we need expert help.
The local constabulary?
I said expert help.
Where from?
The CID, Scotland Yard.
It was a clear, cogent letter reciting the situation as Dr. Ashley and John Davis knew it. It was addressed to the Home Secretary, the gentleman in the British government responsible for the police force in general. In due course, the letter reached the desk of Inspector Charles in Scotland Yard. Following the set routine, Inspector Charles showed the communication to his immediate assistant, Detective Sergeant Hatch.
Well, nothing else for it. You and I will have to take a small trip to the country. Frankly, I won't mind. I can use a touch of country air after all.
They came into the quiet town unobtrusively. Two men on a walking tour, vacationists. They put up at the inn. Toward sundown, they strolled about the town, quite casually. They turned in at the gate with its little sign announcing that Dr. Ashley had his dispensary there. Once, however, within the doctor's office.
Now then, Doctor, perhaps you'd let Sergeant Hatch and I have it from the beginning.
Well, my entrance into the situation came shortly after Mrs. Reed returned from the sanitarium.
She'd been ill?
Mentally ill.
Nervous breakdown?
Rather more than that. She'd been certified insane. She was discharged as being quite stable once again.
And you were called in?
In my professional capacity. I found her past help. Acute gastritis, or so it seemed at the time.
But it doesn't seem so now?
You understand, Inspector, I have no facts. At least not on that side. I merely analyzed the box of candy received by John Davis shortly after he'd been taken ill.
Doctor, would this Colonel Reed benefit from Mr. Davis's death?
There'd been something about a real estate and a deposit paid. Quite a large sum, I believe. Mr. Davis can give you the details.
One final question, sir. Who had Mrs. Reed committed to the institution in the first instance?
Why, I believe the husband did. But the records will be available to you, of course.
Of course. Well, thank you, Doctor. If we need you, we...
By the time they left the doctor's office, Inspector Charles and Sergeant Hatch felt they had heard an interesting, if circumstantial, story. Their next stop, naturally, was John Davis's home.
You've no idea, gentlemen, what a relief it is to have police officers of your caliber on the job.
Thank you. About the candy and the card in the box,
Do you have any definite reason to believe the Colonel wants you, well, out of the way?
There's the matter of £500 he either will not or cannot explain.
And, Dr. Ashley mentioned Mrs. Reed's will.
Yes, curious about that. There was one will made out entirely in favor of her children by her first marriage. The will which was accepted and executed was in the Colonel's handwriting, but signed by Mrs. Reed and produced subsequent to her death.
You find that interesting, I take it, Sergeant?
I expect you do as well, sir.
Quite. Mr. Davis, do you think it might be possible to exhume Mrs. Reed's body without the matter becoming common knowledge in the whole town?
The men from Scotland Yard accomplished the almost impossible. Armed with the proper papers, plus tools and dark lanterns, they supervised the removal of the body at night, with no one the wiser except the necessary officials. This feat completed, they waited quite patiently. The government analyst was called in. The report was brief. Inspector Charles read it to Dr. Ashley.
Examination reveals the presence of 4 grains of arsenic, more than a fatal dose, and the largest amount of the poison I have ever found in human remains. Well, that's it, Doctor.
And I didn't recognize the symptoms. Acute gastritis, I call it.
Why should you have recognized them, sir? I dare say murder of any kind is hardly a common occurrence in your practice. Well, Sergeant, since our warrant is all in order, it begins to appear that a search of Colonel Reed's premises may be next on the agenda.
Now the pretense of the walking tour was completely discarded. It was Saturday, and the sleepy little village was just about bestirring itself. The inspector and the sergeant walked the short distance from the inn to Colonel Reed's place of business, almost directly opposite Davis's office. The sergeant tried the door.
Not locked, sir.
A locked door in these parts would arouse more suspicion than not. Let's go in, shall we?
One file cabinet, one desk, telephone, chair for visitors. Can't do much of a business.
I dare say not. Let's get to it.
The search was quite thorough. The desk was emptied of its contents. These were replaced in an orderly fashion.
Oh, nothing extraordinary here, sir. Oh? What do you make of this, sir?
Champagne glass. Rear of the file cabinet. It's odd.
Shall I hold it aside, sir?
Yes, may as well. Interesting, the trace of sediment. Apparently, it was never washed after it was used the last time. Anything else in there, Sergeant?
Oh, what's going on in here?
Colonel Reed?
Yes. More to the point for you to identify yourselves and your business here, if any.
Inspector Charles, CID. My identity card. This is Sergeant Hatch.
I see. I assume you have a warrant for this search?
We do. Right here, Colonel.
Very well. Go on with your work.
May I ask why you were keeping the champagne glass in the file cabinet?
A memento to my poor wife. We drank from it. Oh, that is, she did, about a week before she passed away.
A nice gesture, if I may say so. And still with a trace of the sediment at the bottom. Careful, sir. It'd be a pity to have the glass break after all this time.
Oh, sorry. Awkward of me to brush against it like that.
Yes, wasn't it? All right, Sergeant, you can open the desk drawer the Colonel just closed and see what he put in it.
But you said you'd finished.
Your pardon, Colonel.
I've had quite enough of this.
These paper packets weren't in here a few minutes ago, Inspector.
How many?
I won't have
20 of them, sir.
I'll take one. Thank you. White powder.
Well?
This wouldn't be arsenic, would it, Colonel?
It not only would be, it is.
Really?
Well, as you can see, I'm wearing my gardening coat. Ordinarily, I do not come into the office on Saturday, but something came up. I've been planning an experiment in my garden, hence the arsenic.
A garden, an experiment? With 20 packets of arsenic?
Yes. My lawn is plagued with dandelions, roughly 2 dozen of them. I plan to drill a small hole at the root of each weed, pour in the arsenic in each of those packets, and kill each dandelion individually, rather than take the chance of ruining the whole lawn.
Sorry, Colonel, it's a good story, but rather far-fetched. Particularly since you tried to rid yourself of the packets before we searched your person. and particularly since the charge pending is willful murder of your wife by arsenical poisoning.
But this is ridiculous! Someone is...
Sergeant! Keep that champagne glass safe before Colonel Reed succeeds in smashing it.
Yes, sir.
Colonel Reed, you are under arrest. The charge is murder. I must warn you that anything you may say...
I will not stand
for it! Hold it, Sergeant! I'll be acquitted, you'll see, and then I'll have to leave here. A trial?
That will make it quite enough, Colonel. You've made several mistakes, not the least of which was your attempt on John Davis, and your preservation of this glass. A sentimental gesture, but rather silly. My bet is the sediment in it will turn out to be arsenic. You must have been very sure of yourself, Colonel, to leave this glass unwashed. Very sure of yourself indeed. Bring him along, Sergeant. I think he'll come quietly now.
And today that champagne glass can be seen in the Black Museum.
Orson Welles will be back with you in just a moment.
There was no doubt about one facet of Colonel Reed's character. He was a man of great pride. His behavior at the trial was exemplary. His bearing, military. He repeated his story of the separate packets of arsenic for separate dandelions, and he sounded as if he'd made a good case of it. At least for himself. But not, as it turned out, for the jury. Colonel Reed accepted his sentence as if it were an order from a superior officer. And one morning, at the traditional time of 8 o'clock, Colonel Reed marched to the scaffold as if he were on parade. And as for the champagne glass, well, it remains in its customary place, as I told you, in Scotland Yard. Now, until we meet next time, in the same place, and I tell you another story about the Black Museum, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
All right, and that was the Black Museum. Coming up after midnight, Mystery in the Air on the WGN Radio Theater.
Back to WGN Radio Theater with Earl Amari and Lisa Wolf.
I think Bill Curtis could have just retaped all that just for us, you know?
Sure.
Tape Flyer and Mike Costello heading for Carl and Lisa on the WGN Radio Theater. By the way, if you love what you're listening to, like WGN Radio Theater on Facebook, follow them on Twitter. And he's got some cool stuff that's available, as you've heard in some of the spots, for sale.
Right, Classic Radio Club.
That's right. So you can go to WGNRadioTheater.com and I think get all that information on that
definitely.
As well. So we've got this mystery in the air, and I was saying in the beginning of the show, and Roger, I don't know about you. Are you still there, Roger?
Yeah, I'm here.
So first getting introduced to all this stuff was Suspense, and I think I bought them on these little – they were on albums, record albums. Mm-hmm. And it was the company was called Radiola. It was long before before Carl found his company. You know what I'm talking about?
Right.
Those old albums. And I played Sorry, Wrong Number, but, you know, every year on my show I play some classic radio, too, because it's just great stuff for Halloween. But it's a great way to get people, like, into old-time radio. Like, every year we go down right before Halloween to my family's down in Monticello, a little bit west of Champaign, and they've got a lot of property there, and they got a lake, and we throw a bonfire out there, and it's way far away from the house. And there's usually about 30, 35 of us out there, and ages range from, I'm going to say, 6 to 80. And we're all sitting around there. We all got our marshmallows, our s'mores, all that other good stuff. And then you throw on a Suspense episode on a country road, and first of all, the kids have no idea what this is. This is a story made for radio, you know, like what is that all about?
Right.
You know, but the fact that they listened to the first episode and they sat almost perfectly still and you hear the wind blowing and it's dark out just from the light of the fire. It is so much fun. And if you get an opportunity to do that, grab the family and some younger kids too. They were like, is there another one? Is there another one? There's hundreds of them. There's thousands of them.
I had never heard any of these until I started working for Carl.
Yeah.
So that's why, you know, I like Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. That was one of the first shows that I really started to listen to often.
Yeah,
while
okay,
working
that one
with
specifically.
Carl. So,
okay.
Yeah, that's right. Why I'm very in tune with that.
Yeah.
that show.
And for Roger, I mean, he was there during the Golden Age of Radio in the 20s when...
I named it.
You named it.
I said, baby, this stuff is golden.
That's right. That's right. Of course. Of course you did.
But seriously, this...
But seriously,
I have
folks.
Tried to make this as part... of my 20 years of teaching broadcasting, because it was a part of my broadcasting education, too. But I tried to make this part an actual unit within the curriculum. And I was actually brought to Washington, D.C. as part of a team to help rewrite their broadcasting curriculum for their high schools. All of their high schools had industrial technology component to it. And you could sign up for 3 or 4 years of radio TV broadcasting. And I actually made this part of the history of broadcasting curriculum in Washington, D.C.
That's cool.
And
which it is.
But in order to appreciate what we have now in radio, and I'm not talking about podcasts, I'm not talking about listening to us on an app or anything. I'm just talking about radio. Like you just described, having that playing out in the middle at
night.
Yeah,
the atmosphere is perfect.
And to do that and have people understand and appreciate where radio came from and what's still possible, that made my day. And when the students, and I'm sure Mike has this in his classes, when your students finally get it and their eyes start to light up and they realize what they can do on their own.
Oh, yeah,
to
absolutely.
Make the magic happen?
Oh, I always want my students to completely succeed and discover, you know?
Yeah.
So Mike teaches at Columbia College, which I just found out as well, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Now, some of this old-time radio stuff, too, can, you know, some of the comedies can be a little dated, but, I mean, for the most part, you know, you listen to Jack Benny, funny is funny.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter.
Oh, yeah.
When it took place, right?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's why I have a hard time with the comedies.
Yeah,
because they're pretty dated for me. So
yeah, yeah. But the
especially
Jack
the variety
stuff.
Ones where you have different guests that come in. Yeah, the singing stuff and a lot of the Bing Crosby comments and Bob Hope comments. It is dated. But
I kind of look at some of that as history. It's just when the jokes are dated is what I'm talking about. But you know, Jack Benny, you can't beat any
because
of that.
It's situational. It's it's situational comedy, and it's timeless.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
but you have to do is play Abbott and Costello, who's on first, and by the end of it, they're laughing.
Now, speaking of Abbott and Costello, so the next show we're going to be listening to is Mystery in the Air, and this was a summer replacement series for Abbott and Costello, which is odd because back then, a comedy was replaced with a comedy, a drama was replaced with a drama. And it was, I think, 1945 to 1947, this show was part of that. Peter Lorre, who, you know, pretty legendary, you know, actor, obviously, in all this, is the host and star of the show. And a guy named Henry Morgan, who is the announcer, was actually changed his name later to Harry Morgan, who was in Dragnet and later was Colonel Potter on MASH. And he's going to be doing this as well.
Yes.
If that reminds, there you go. But, you know, here's another funny thing. I was watching last holidays. We were passing through some channels looking for a holiday movie, and the Hallmark Channel or something came up, and it was a Walton's movie, Christmas movie. And they were all sitting around the radio watching the radio. And my six-year-old said, "Why are they watching the radio?" Well, that's where the sound was coming out.
Right.
So that's where, you know, you weren't staring with each other because you were kind of staring off into the distance as you were thinking about the situation and what the characters look like and kind of formulating, you know, your part of the story in all this. And Mystery of the Air is one of those shows, too, that it's dark. You know, it's a little creepy. It's chilling. And it opens with this like death march music, right in the very beginning. So when we come back, we're going to play, Mystery in the Air, and the, episode is Crime and Punishment. Am I correct?
That is correct. It's from September 25th, 1947.
And we'll do that after this on 720 WGN.
This hour coming up, Mystery in the Air. This is an episode called Crime and Punishment. It's from September 25th, 1947. The information that I have here is it's about a young man, student, pawnbroker, and murder. So let's take a listen to the first portion of Mystery in the Air.
Mystery in the Air, starring Peter Lorre.
it is now my great pleasure to confer our academic degree with honor on the most distinguished student of this class. Roderick Raskolnikov, step forward. In the history of our university, there have been few young men who've compared with him in mental brilliance, and few for whom the future held greater promise. Roderick, I've spoken for the university. Now I want to speak for myself. As a token of the esteem in which I hold you and your abilities, I want to present you with this watch.
Thank you, sir.
Read the inscription.
To Roderick Raskolnikov, may his great gifts bring him the reward of honor and good fortune. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Roderick, my boy, I'm proud to have had you as one of us, and sad that you are leaving. Good luck to you, and God bless you.
Again tonight, Peter Lorre, in the excitement of the great stories of the strange and unusual, of dark and compelling masterpieces culled from the four corners of world literature. Tonight, Crime and Punishment, adapted from the motion picture starring Peter Lorre and based on the novel by Fyodor Dostoevsky.
Mystery in the Air, starring Peter Lorre.
So I, Roderick Raskolnikov, went to the city to achieve honor and good fortune. But 1 year later, I had achieved neither. Oh, I had written one book, a book on crime, which I had to sell to a publisher for barely enough money to pay my first 6 months' rent. Oh, the reviews were very nice. Yes, one of them said, the subject is handled with such brilliance that one wonders whether it's the work of a genius or a great detective, or both. Genius or great detective. Can't eat reviews. All the time I was starving in a garret room. Come in. Oh, it's you, Mrs. Barnum.
Yes, it's me. I haven't had a penny out of you in 6 months.
I know.
How much longer do you expect me to wait for my rent?
Well, can you stand the strain another half hour?
Oh, so you're going to pay me in half an hour?
Yes.
Just how are you going to raise the money?
Oh, that's very simple. I'm going to rob a bank.
Think you're funny, huh? Well, I don't. You're a disgrace to my house.
Maybe, but someday they'll put a sign on this house that I, Raskolnikov, had the privilege of starving here. I beg your pardon. Is there a pawnbroker? I think it's an old woman by the name of Leona. Does she live here?
Yes, one more flight up. I'll show you.
Yeah.
I'm going there myself.
Thank you very much. May I carry your package?
No. No, I can manage. It's this door here. Just ring the bell.
What do you want? Ah, it's you, Sonia. Come in. Who's this? One of your gentleman friends?
No, I met him on the stairs.
Well, what have you got this time?
This. This Bible.
And where did you steal this?
I didn't steal it. It's been in our family a long time.
What do you want for it?
The cover's inlaid with mother of pearl. Stones are garnet. Worth at least 100 rubles.
I'll give you 6 rubles for it.
But
if you don't want it, leave it. What have you got, mister?
I have a watch.
I'll take the 6.
Here you are.
You said 6 rubles. You gave me 1.
That's right, 6 rubles. Less 3 months interest for your shawl and 2 months on the necklace and silver buckles. That makes 5 rubles. 5 from 6 is 1 ruble. Well, what are you waiting for? Want your Bible back?
No.
Well, come on, get out, get out! I'm a little gutter snipe. All right, mister, let me see your watch.
Here.
To Roderick Raskolnikov.
That's me.
May his great gifts bring him the reward of honor and good fortune. It's inscribed. I can't give you as much.
I want 50 rubles on it.
I'll give you 10.
All right, give me the 10.
There you are. What are you staring at? Don't look at me like that.
I'm not looking. I'm not staring. I was watching you put the young lady's Bible and my watch into that trunk. That's all.
But I've got nothing in here. Nothing but a lot of trash. A lot of trash. Get out of here.
As you say. Forgive me. Oh, it's you, Miss Sonia. What are you looking for?
My ruble. Dropped out of my hand when she pushed me out the door.
Somebody ought to push her straight into the next world. What use is all that money to her? Is her miserly life worth 100 others like yours and mine? I'd like to take her by the throat.
You shouldn't say things like that.
Oh, that black beetle. Here's your ruble. I found it.
You didn't find that. You took a ruble out of your pocket.
I didn't know. I swear I didn't.
Well, I... Thank you. I forgot there was still some kindness in the world.
I forgot that there was still some beauty in it.
What do you want at this hour? It's after midnight.
It's me, Raskolnikov, don't you remember? Got a valuable vanity case this time.
Fine hour this is to come around with your rubbish. But come in. Let's see this valuable vanity case.
Here.
It's heavy enough. What's it made of, lead?
Gold.
I'll believe that when I see it. Oh, what's the idea of making so many knots? I can't untie this thing.
I'll show you the idea.
Put down that poker! Put down that poker!
I will! Please! On your head, you dirty! You old hag! Come in. Oh, good morning, Miss Parson. Fine day, don't you think? Very fine day, huh?
I didn't come up here about the weather.
Oh, no. It's about the money, yes. Well, I'll have it today. I promise I'll have it today.
Not about the money, either.
No, about what?
There's a policeman downstairs.
Policeman? What is he?
Here he is now. Ask him yourself.
Are you the writer of Raskolnikov?
Yes.
Well, come along with me. You're wanted at headquarters.
There must be some mistake. Yes, there must be some mistake. I haven't done anything. What have I done?
Find out when you get there. Come along.
Well, that's part one of Mystery in the Air on the WGN Radio Theater. He played some really interesting roles, Peter Lorre, over his long career.
Yes, this is true.
And he turned down a lot of parts. Like, he was supposed to be in Son of Frankenstein and all kinds of stuff. He was in Casablanca. He was the first actor to play a James Bond villain. But it was a TV adaptation of Casino Royale in 1954.
Huh.
Which I wouldn't even have associated with the James Bond films. Also had a sense of humor. I was reading just some fun facts on this guy. He attended Bela Lugosi's funeral in 1956, who played Dracula, and seeing the deceased actor laid out in his signature Dracula costume, because that's what he was buried in, his Dracula costume, he turned to Vincent Price, another classic voice in all this, and said, "Do you think we should drive a stake through his heart just in case?" I like this guy. He had some health issues. I know he died in 1964, and by that point he was playing roles that was parodying himself in a lot of that. But he had a really just an amazing career in Hollywood, really only for about 20 years. He came here right at the dawn of World War II.
Huh, interesting.
Kind of a cool guy. But Mystery in the Air, always cool to hear his voice. We're going to play part two after this on the WGN Radio Theater. So Carl and Lisa are back next week, and what do they got coming up?
I don't know. Let's take a look here. Next Saturday, we have Inner Sanctum, Crime Classics, The Sealed Book. And on that Sunday, we have Lights Out and Suspense.
Lights Out is... So Lights Out, Suspense, and what's the other one I'm thinking of?
Inner Sanctum.
Inner Sanctum, thank you. I think Lights Out is the one that's really creepy. Like, that's the horror, really horror version of
it. Yeah, a lot of Lights Out is pretty creepy.
Right? I mean, it's like you really got... And you got to pay attention. I mean, not that you're not paying attention anyway. Like, I could do stuff around the house and listen to old-time radio. That one, I feel like I got to sit still and listen to it. Because there's some suspense that are more mystery-related.
Right,
but that one is pretty creepy. And so is Inner Sanctum. I like that.
Well, isn't Inner Sanctum the one with the squeaky door? Isn't that the one where the introduction?
Yes.
Right. That's the squeaky door. But the turn your lights out, the announcer's...
Lights.
Turn your lights out. Mm-hmm. Like that at the beginning.
They start the whole thing telling you, like, if you're not in the scary things, turn off the radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love some of these, very creative on the openings of a lot of these shows. So, yeah, it's scary stuff. Yeah.
I got to listen to more of this stuff during the week. You can get some of these things on Carl's website, too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Check it out.
WGNRadioTheater.com.
He's got his club going on, Classic Radio Club. We have definitely some other sites where we post our products, and you can make purchases. They're all fully restored. And, check out Classic Radio Club, actually. That's a newer thing, and it's really cool. You got a collection of 5 CDs, and it's... He's going to be putting out a lot of things that maybe you may have never heard before.
That's cool.
So things that we've never broadcasted and just stuff that isn't common, but a lot of old-time radio that is very interesting and covering a lot of different genres.
Back to WGN Radio Theater with Earl Amari and Lisa Wolf.
Well, here we back. We're back. It's Dave Flyer and Mike Costellan for Carl and Lisa, who are hungover from last night. Right, Roger? Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
From a Halloween party, so I guess it's a little
Which is unusual that they were both hungover at the same time.
Yeah. It happens.
Well, Carl's been hungover for 2 days. Lisa's been hungover for 1 day. They've been drinking Roma wine.
I like
there
this.
You go.
Oh,
yeah.
God. Oh, man. It might be good by now. I don't know. It might be good or really bad. We'll have to see what happens. We are now on the part two of Mystery in the Air that we're playing tonight with Peter Lorre. And tonight's episode is called Crime and Punishment. Here's part two.
Roderick Raskolnikov, trembling with fear, now stands before the clerk in the police station.
Raskolnikov. Yeah. Let's see. Well, you owe your landlady 30 rubles, and you'll refuse to vacate the premises.
Is that why? Is that why I've been brought here?
Yes. Are you going to pay, or must we throw you out?
No. I'll pay. I'll pay tomorrow. No, it's
quiet.
My rent. It's
not funny. Quiet.
No, it's the rent. You see it.
Quiet, I say.
30 rubles. That's why I've been brought here. Yeah. It's wonderful.
Stop that shouting. Now stop it. What's going on here? Who's that maniac? He's a writer named Raskolnikov. Huh? Oh, Raskolnikov. Just the man I want to see.
Me? Why, sir?
I'm Inspector Porfiry.
Oh, Commissioner.
I read your excellent book about the crime and criminals.
Oh, you flatter me, sir.
Oh, no, I really mean it. You know, I thought I knew something about the subject, but your book put me and my staff in the kindergarten class. Okay. I must talk to you. Come into my office.
Thank you, sir.
And by the way, perhaps you'd like to help us on a new murder case. It'll give you a chance to see how the blundering police work.
Well, a murder case when...
An old pawnbroker was killed last night.
Huh?
A well-known character named Leona.
Yes, I...
I've heard of her.
Oh? What do you know about her?
Nothing. Nothing at all. Think you'll get him easily? Guilty man?
Who knows? We may have him now.
What do you mean?
We brought a man in this morning, a house painter. He had been working in a flat under Leona's.
Do you think he did it?
Well, it doesn't really matter. He was found with a pair of earrings. He had blood on his hands. Oh, of course, he has an explanation for these things, but he'll do as a suspect just to keep our records clear.
You mean that...
Of course, of course. But come, come, let's discuss your book. Let's see if your theory can be applied to this case.
My theory?
Yes. You wrote that ordinary men must obey the law because they are ordinary. But extraordinary men have the right to transgress the law.
No.
Isn't that right?
No, 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 not exactly. What I said was that extraordinary men shouldn't be judged by ordinary standards. For example, take Napoleon if...
I doubt if Napoleon murdered the old pawnbroker.
Oh. I'm glad my theories give you a chance to be witty.
If your theory is right, it would make it a lot simpler for us policemen. If your extraordinary men had some distinguishing mark, say a medal or a ribbon... Or a resemblance to Napoleon.
What do you mean?
Like yourself, for instance. But to get back to our murderer in this case, he was ordinary enough, all right. Nothing but a stupid coward.
What do you mean?
If he hadn't been in a panic, he'd have found the old woman's money. 1,500 rubles tucked away in the mattress. Instead, he took a lot of junk that's no use to him, and he can't unload it. I've got my men watching every outlet.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Inspector, you've promised to show me your blundering police methods, and you certainly have. You're holding a man who's probably entirely innocent just to keep your records clear, huh?
Well, the painter will do until the real murderer comes in, and he will come in. He'll give himself up through fear. Fear of the law or of God.
Oh, yes?
In the meantime, I'll just wait.
I admit I was furious, stupid, coward indeed. But then I realized that I wasn't a coward at all on the contrary. In facing the inspector so calmly, I'd learned not to be afraid. Still, I needed money, and now I didn't dare to sell any of the old woman's stuff. I determined to try my newfound courage on a publisher of my book.
Sit down, Mr. Raskolnikov. I'm glad to see you. We had very nice response on your book.
Oh, that's good. I've almost finished another one.
Oh, is that so? Oh, you might let us see it when it's done.
Well, you see, as a matter of fact, another publisher, well, he has offered me an advance of 750 rubles on it.
He has?
Yes.
Oh, the pirate. You're my discovery.
Well...
Look, I'll give you 1,000 rubles advance. Hmm? How's that?
Oh, that's fine. That's wonderful. Yes, it's wonderful. I took the money. I paid my landlady in full. I bought myself a whole new outfit of clothes. Oh, I was riding on top of the world. But then a disturbing thought occurred to me. Of course, the inspector hadn't suspected me for a moment, but undoubtedly he would find my name in the old pawnbroker's books. He might think it curious. I hadn't mentioned it myself. I decided to go and see him again, voluntarily, yes, out of my own free will. That's what an innocent man would do, or would he? Well, anyway, I'm going.
The inspector will see you in just a moment.
Thank you, I'm in no hurry.
Well, Mr. Raskolnikov.
Sonia, what are you doing here?
The inspector sent for me. He returned my Bible. He asked me a few questions.
Questions? What kind of questions?
About the day I went to the pawnbroker.
Did he want to know anything about me?
Yes.
What did you tell him?
About the money you gave me.
Oh.
And then he wanted to know.
Why? What did he want to know?
Before I knew what had happened... He made me tell him what you said.
What?
Did she deserve to die?
Well, she did, she...
The inspector will see you now, Mr. Raskolnikov.
Sonia, I must see you later. Where do you live?
Catherine Street. First house from the bridge, second floor.
I'll be over as soon as I can. Wait for me.
This way, sir.
Thank you.
Ah, Mr. Raskolnikov. I'm delighted to see you again.
Come to claim my watch.
Yeah. Your watch?
Come on, let's not beat around the bush. I hated to part with it, but I need the money, so I took it to the old woman and...
What
I...
old woman?
Oh, you know, the pawnbroker, the one we were talking about.
Oh, did you have dealings with her?
Did I? You know I had. You know I was there. I mean, isn't my name in her book?
Oh, wait a minute. Why, so it is. Funny, I didn't notice it.
What are you trying to do, upset me?
Upset me? No, not at all. And I'm sorry, but there's no watch listed among her effects. I'm afraid it's still in the murderer's possession.
Well, thank you very much. I must be going out.
Oh, by the way, that's a new suit, isn't it?
Hmm? Yes, it is. What of it? Why shouldn't I be wearing a new suit, huh?
Things have taken a turn for the better, eh?
Yes, things have taken a turn for the better. I sold another book.
Congratulations. I hope you'll have some theories in this one that'll help me solve this murder. We're still holding that poor wretch of a painter.
Oh. Your real murderer hasn't come in, huh?
No, not yet. But I haven't given up hope.
Oh, you're very optimistic. That's good. Suspect anyone in particular?
Oh, I suspect anyone and everyone.
That's good.
I'll admit now that for a time I even connected you with the murder.
Me?
Yes. You know how a policeman's mind functions.
No, I don't.
I began piecing things in a pattern. Your desperate poverty, the fact you almost fainted when I mentioned the murder the first time.
Oh.
Your talk of Superman being above the law.
Oh, now I can see.
You're going around town flashing all that money,
which
I didn't know until just now came from your publisher.
You had me followed, huh?
Well, a matter of routine.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you something. If I were the guilty man, I'd be too smart to try to sell that junk. I'd have gone into the country and buried it under stone. You hear me? Yes, under a big, heavy stone.
So?
Come on, accuse me of murder if you like, but don't insult me by believing that I'd overlook 1,500 rubles in a mattress. Try your clumsy methods on halfwits, like that poor fool you're going to sacrifice, just to keep your records clear.
But I'm not accusing you. I don't accuse a man I think is guilty if I have no proof. I just sit and wait.
Yeah, you sit and wait. Stop playing this cat and mouse game with me.
Yes.
If you think you have a case against me, come on, arrest me or bring me to a trial. I'll show you how.
Yes, I did.
Inspector,
I did.
This man just confessed.
Yes, I confess. I'm guilty. I'm the murderer. Punish me.
You're lying, you fool. You didn't kill her.
I hit her over the head with a poker. I hate her.
You idiot. You didn't even know about her until we arrested you. You didn't know anything about it until we beat it into you. Take him away, officer. If you want to go to Siberia that badly.
I'm guilty, I tell you. I'm guilty.
Get him out of here.
Oh, what a triumph for your methods, Inspector. First you tried to make him confess, and now you try to make him believe he's innocent. Doesn't your conscience ever bother you?
No. Let the real murderer suffer from his conscience. It'll trouble him. He's no Napoleon. No, he's not hard enough. He'll come in, and I'll be waiting for him. I'll be waiting.
Good luck. Me.
Oh, where have you been?
No, I'm walking the streets. I don't know how long. I know it's late. I had to talk to you, Sonia. I may never see you again.
You're going away?
Yes.
Where are you going?
I don't know.
And why?
Because I'm free now. Yes, I'm free. Free to go where I please and do what I please and...
Free? From what?
Police. They suspected me of the murder. Oh, it's all over now. Sonia, come away with me.
Did they find the guilty man?
They had him all along. He confessed this morning.
Who was it?
Oh, a painter who worked in a house. Why all these questions? Leave me alone. I've been questioned enough. Please put that Bible away.
I don't want to be reminded of that old hag.
And Jesus said, take away the stone.
What stone? What stone are you talking about? How do you know I hid it under a stone?
It's the stone under which Lazarus was buried. Then they took away the stone from the place where the dead man was. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, thou hast heard me. And when he had thus spoken, he cried in a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And he that was dead came forth.
Sonia. Sonia!
You should kneel to me.
Have mercy on me, Sonia. I killed that old woman. I killed her.
Why did you do it?
I was mad. What shall I do now?
I don't know what to tell you. Because you have no faith.
But if I did have faith,
then I would tell you to confess.
Huh?
Atone for what you've done.
Confess to the police?
How else can you save the one who's being punished in your place?
Confess and go to Siberia and rot in prison, Sonia? How can you ask me to do that?
Because I love you.
Sonia, I know it. I know it now. I have faith. You have given it to me. You have made me see myself, as I really was, and just a coward who thought himself brave. All right, Sonia, I'll go and do as you say.
Oh, my darling. I'll wait for you. I'll always wait for you. Forever.
Come in.
Good evening, Inspector.
Good evening, Raskolnikov. I've been expecting you. I've been expecting you for quite a long time.
And now here is Peter Lorre for a final word.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, in a way, this is my final word, because tonight our summer series of classic mysteries comes to a close. I feel deeply grateful for your response to our efforts, and I certainly feel compelled to express my deep appreciation for all those men who have worked with me, especially our director, Mr. Cal Coon.
Crime and Punishment has been adapted from the screenplay Crime and Punishment by arrangement with Columbia Pictures, producers of the Technicolor musical Down to Earth. Listen next Thursday at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 9 p.m. Central Standard Time, 8 p.m. Mountain Time, and 7 p.m. Pacific Time for the Bob Hawke Show over these same NBC stations. Music for Mystery in the Air was composed and conducted by Paul Barron. The artists supporting Mr. Lorre tonight were Henry Morgan, Peggy Weber, Joe Kearns, Ben Wright, Louis Van Ruten, Gloria Ann Simpson, and Herbert Butterfield. This is Michael Roy in Hollywood. Good night.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
All right, then. Oh. Jeez. That's sacrilegious that I just talked over that. I shouldn't have done that. Am I in trouble now?
I think you're good.
All right. That was Mystery in the Air with Peter Lorre. Perfect for this time of year. Also, all these horror genre programs. Next week, Inner Sanctum Mystery, Crime Classics, A Sealed Book, Lights Out, and Suspense. You can't get any better than that. Inner Sanctum, I was looking at this. Inner Sanctum was a book series first. It was a Simon & Schuster book series. But it was also, and I think about these radio shows, you know, when these series now on like Netflix do like 8 episodes.
Right.
They used to do like 40, 50 a season. There were 511 Inner Sanctum episodes. And I wow. know thousands, I think, of Suspense. All these shows at some point, these horror mystery shows, Inner Sanctum, Suspense, Lights Out, tried to make it to television,
right,
like when television came, and they lasted like a year or two, and they were terrible because I think people were so used to just being able to think about what was happening instead of seeing it and having someone else interpret these stories for you. You know? I
mean, yeah,
that's how I think about that.
Yeah, I agree. The most interesting thing in relation to television for me is the idea of sometimes I see things now on TV and I'm like, oh, they did that in an episode of this old time radio show. So I feel like everything has already been done that you see on TV.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And then they did these Inner Sanctum. It was, again, book, television, radio. There were very low budget Universal horror movies called An Inner Sanctum Mystery. And there was Calling Dr. Death, Weird Woman, Dead Man's Eyes, The Frozen Ghost, Strange Confession, The Pillow of Death. And then there was an actual Inner Sanctum movie that was out there as well. But none did very well at all. Like, the TV series was like 1 year. Kind of crazy. But these radio shows are phenomenal.
Right. Yeah.
They last forever.